Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump come out of the New York primary as winners, with Trump inching towards the minimum delegate count required for an uncontested GOP convention. It's Politics Day on River to River. I'm Emily Woodbury in for Ben Kiefer. I'm joined today by political analyst Stefan Schmidt of Iowa State and Hans Hassel of Cornell College. We'll talk about the New York primary results, other presidential campaign-related news, and we'll take a look at forces influencing the more local 2016 elections, including Iowa's open Senate seat and how the balance of power in the Iowa State House could sway one way or the other. That's all coming up after this news from NPR. Good afternoon. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Emily Woodbury in for Ben Kiefer. It's Politics Day today, and we'll be talking about the results of the New York primary, the presidential election, and what's happening with each of the campaigns of the five candidates left in the race. If you have concerns or questions about a contested GOP convention in July, or if you have some thoughts on what happened yesterday in New York, you can give us a call at 866-780-9100, email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Again, that number to call is 866-780-9100. Later in the program, we're going to be talking about the fact that Governor Branstad, along with Republican lawmakers at the State House, are considering a measure to defund Planned Parenthood. We're going to talk about that a little bit later on. But first, the New York primary results. And with me today, Stefan Schmidt, University Professor of Political Science at Iowa State. Hi, Stefan. And Hans Hassel, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Cornell College. How are you? All right. Well, Donald Trump, who was raised in Queens, he won big in New York last night, securing more than 60% of the vote and 89 delegates so far. Here's a clip from Trump's victory speech last night. And just to note that chanting has been shortened.
It's really nice to win the delegates with the votes. You know, it's really nice. Nobody should be given delegates, which is a ticket to victory, and it's not a fair ticket. And even though we're leading by a lot and we can't be caught, it's impossible to catch us. Nobody should take delegates and claim victory unless they get those delegates with voters and voting. And that's what's going to happen. And you watch. Because the people aren't going to stand for it.
So, Hans, is it safe to say that Trump has regained his footing in the race?
I think that what you're going to see in the next couple of days, is a couple of weeks with these primaries in the Northeast, is you're going to see instances where the battleground shifts to a place where Trump is much more wildly popular. He's got a lot more support in those areas. He's done better in those areas. Those are areas that Ted Cruz has really struggled with. So for the next week, these primaries, New York yesterday and the primaries in Delaware and Rhode Island and others next week is, I think, going to shift towards Trump. But then you shift back towards places like Nebraska in early May, and you see a battleground that's much more favorable to Ted Cruz. So what you're seeing here is essentially a shift in what's going on and who's voting.
Well, Hans, I hear what you're saying, and you have some great analysis, but I'm going to be honest, it a little bit sounds like you're in outer space, so we might try giving you a call on another line really quick. Stefan, Kasich received 25% of the vote and about three delegates from New York, which is the minimum that pundits were saying he would need. Yet, on the other hand, he came out in second, and Cruz received zero delegates. How do yesterday's results impact the competition between Cruz and Kasich?
In the case of the Republicans, it was obviously, a tremendous victory for Donald Trump. I mean, he was supposed to win. He won by a lot more than anyone expected, got almost all the delegates. And Kasich is still there. He's sort of the stepson of all of this, kind of not at the table all the time. But he has a role. You know, his role is essentially to keep alive an option in case delegates to the Republican convention want someone, besides Cruz and Trump. That doesn't look very likely anymore, and I'll be honest with you, I think that it's going to be a tough race for Cruz. I think a little bit later you may want to talk about what the Republican establishment is talking about at the Republican convention in terms of the numbers of delegates. I'm not going to preempt that because that is an important piece of this whole story.
Mm-hmm. And Hans is back on the line. Welcome back, Hans.
am I back from outer space?
Oh, you are back. You are on Earth now. You sound great. Well, Stefan, I'd like to have you comment on what Hans was talking about earlier about how Trump came out of New York. Were you very surprised by the results?
Well, I wasn't. I mean, we knew that this was going to happen. Even the polls showed that, Kasich was going to come in second. Trump was going to win more than 50%. And so, no, there were no surprises. And there weren't any on the other side either. So it was an evening in which the pollsters were in some way vindicated because, the pollsters have been wrong in some races. But in this one, it was pretty good.
Mm-hmm. Now, we have Connecticut, Delaware, and Pennsylvania. These are a few states that are coming up very soon. What are voters looking for in these states? When we look at the GOP side, are they looking for a more solid establishment candidate, even though Kasich has not said he's establishment? He's kind of been forced into that establishment role. We have Christian conservatism or kind of business-oriented voters. What do we know about these states and how their voters will?
So a lot of these states are states where the Republican Party has really struggled in the past, right? There are not a lot of Republicans from Delaware. There are not a lot of Republicans from Connecticut. I mean, there are a few, but as a result, these are areas that the party organization has atrophied a little bit, and so a lot of people that are Republican are there because they're Republican because they're ideologically driven. Right, you see Delaware, the classic example with Christine O'Donnell a couple of years ago, where the Republican Party had Mike Castle as a very strong senatorial candidate, facing an inexperienced Christine O'Donnell, who was able to appeal to the base there in much the same way that Trump is appealing to the base. And was able to upset that. And so I think that what we've essentially got is that you've got a demographic of states here that are more favorable to Donald Trump, in part because of the nature of politics there, right? The party organization is not as strong. And so you don't get people that are as well connected to the party that has and that are perhaps concerned more about ideological principle than they are about winning elections.
And do you think that spells doom for someone like John Kasich?
I think the Northeast is a very difficult place for him to campaign. I think that you're gonna see him do much better once we move past this New England set of primaries, which is in early May. So this week and next week, but then in May we start going out to Nebraska and other places that are a little bit more friendly. I think that Kasich may actually do better than Cruz. Cruz is the one that's really going to struggle in those states, I think.
In the states as we move further west, or you mean in the New England area?
New England, right, because Cruz's base is this Christian conservative brand of Republicanism, and that's not the brand of Republican principles that you see in the Northeast.
I'd like to have you both answer this. Besides the states we've mentioned and maybe including them, what states are you most looking forward to seeing the results from? Are there some states that have more influence delegate-wise? Stefan, do you want to start that off?
Well, I mean, California clearly is enormous because it has so many delegates, and the polls are great for Donald Trump there. There are some states like Indiana that have a lot of delegates. But I mean, my own view is I kind of agree that, there's a different dynamic in some of the remaining upcoming states, and some may favor Cruz. But I think Donald Trump is going to have a run on a lot of the Northeastern primaries and perhaps be able to, in his case, it's important to understand that he also has to convince Republican uncommitted delegates who are equivalent to the Democrat superdelegates. We always say the Democrats have superdelegates who don't have to be elected by voters, and we always forget that the Republicans, in some sense at least, they also have superdelegates. They just don't call them that. Those are people that go to the convention. They don't have to win. They don't have to vote for how the voters in the state voted. That's true in Pennsylvania, for example. So Donald Trump's victories, to some extent, if they are big like New York, are a warning to those delegates that can go to the Republican convention without, you know, being committed, that Donald Trump is doing very well and that they cannot dismiss him. And I think that's an important thing that I have not heard many people talk about, and perhaps it's breaking news, and so I always give Iowa Public Radio breaking news when I can.
Hans, do you agree with that?
I mean, I think that Stefan is right that Indiana and California matter. I think he's also right that I mean, part of this is sending a signal to people that may be convincible. Stefan talks about these people on the first ballot, but also on subsequent ballots as well, right? What does it mean to when a candidate can't get to that first to that majority level of votes at the convention, and what do those delegates do on the subsequent ballots when they're not bound to a particular candidate? But I think that what Stefan is missing here is that a lot of that perception is momentum, right? So we right now perceive Trump to be doing very well because he won 90 out of 95 delegates in New York. But how is that going to change when we go to New Mexico or Oregon or Washington or right, some of these places where the demographic of Republicans voting in primaries and does not favor him in the same way? And these are ones that are perhaps closer to the convention. And so part of this is going to be saying, right, so he's right now he's perceived as, you know, doing very well. But will that same perception, carry over when we start seeing some of these other states and the primaries that they have in a week or so?
You mentioned demographics in places like New Mexico. Are you referring to Donald Trump's view on immigration?
I think immigration is part of it, but I think it's more, right, it's the type of voter that he's won in the past, right? It's this working class, uneducated individual who does not have a lot of political experience that's been very attracted to Trump. In New Mexico, where you've got a stronger history of Republican politics, in Oregon and Washington, where you have a higher number of individuals who have a higher education, right? Those are the type of people that are less likely to vote for Donald Trump. And it's that sort of demographics that really drive those effects, I think.
But can we just briefly move from demographics to mathematics? Because I'm looking at the Dallas Morning News, which is certainly the paper that knows all of this best because Cruz is from Texas and they really follow him. Hard math, Cruz now needs 9 out of every 10 delegates to clinch the
yeah,
the number. 9 out of 10. I mean, that's enormous. I don't see how he can do that.
Yeah, but I think, Stefan, you saw a couple of weeks ago in Cruz's victory speech, I believe it was in Wisconsin, where he's recognized that in order to win the nomination now, the goal is to prevent Trump from winning 1,237 delegates. That's the goal, I think, for most. That's the reason Kasich is still in, right? Kasich has no chance of winning. His hope
is... Sure, but Cruz needs to get 87% of the remaining delegates, and yeah, you're right. He may get some, but, we can discuss this, I guess, until the convention, which is actually when we will finally know, or maybe we'll know after California. I actually think, in a sense, South Dakota could be the crucial primary. And I'm saying that as a joke, but I was just recently there giving a keynote speech to a group, and their primary is June 7th. And I said, you poor people, you probably never get anyone coming here because by June 7th, somebody's got the necessary delegates. And they said, well, this year maybe not. So maybe the delegates from South Dakota will be the ones that will tell us who gets the 1,237, which is amazing.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about the convention in July. Someone brought up recently this idea of unbound delegates, which I don't think many people know about. Specifically, Steve House, he's the Colorado GOP chairman. He himself is an unbound delegate. And he said he thinks if Trump gets within 50 to 100 delegates of that grand total that he needs, 1,237, he'll be able to carry it because of these unbound delegates. What is he talking about here?
Go ahead. You answer it.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think it's a perception, right? I think that there is there is a concern about legitimacy here, that Republican elites are concerned, are trying to support. Right, you don't want to be perceived as an illegitimate organization that's biased in how you choose the nominee, right?
So changing the rules too much, for instance.
Exactly. Yeah. So there's this concern here that, right, if Trump is within a percentage point or, you know, a couple percentage points of winning the you know, 50% of the delegates, right? What does it say if the party says, sorry, you didn't get 50%, we can't have you as the nominee? And so I think that there's this perception that, right, if he gets to that certain point, if he gets close enough, these unbound delegates may say, well, right, we really don't like him. We don't think he's the best candidate, but we're concerned about the brand image of the party more than we are about losing this one election. Right, we think this will cost us the election, but we're willing to lose an election to save the brand.
And also, I mean, really, they don't like Ted Cruz very much, the establishment type delegates. So between them, between Trump and Cruz, it's kind of Tweedledee, Tweedledum. They think both of them are not what the Republican Party should have. They know that Cruz is a bomb thrower who has shut the government down, is disrespectful of party leaders. And so to some extent, I've seen some interviews. These delegates that can go either way, they just aren't convinced, you know, that Donald Trump is the worst of the two candidates, because Ted Cruz is much more of a true believer and may cost the Republicans more. Donald Trump, remember, doesn't really believe in much of anything. And he can move around. He's already started talking about women, and he's become mild. He's calling Cruz Senator Cruz instead of lying Ted. And so Donald Trump is a salesman, and a lot of people think that he can overcome a lot of the negatives simply by virtue of his marketing skills.
We're talking politics today on River to River. You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. Again, that's 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk or email us at rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. I want to, before we head into the results of the Democratic New York primary, I want to talk a little bit about Paul Ryan. He's back in the news. He was interviewed by CNN recently, and in response to the idea that some GOP lawmakers are considering skipping the convention, the House Speaker strongly urged his fellow Republicans to attend and stand united behind whoever delegates choose as their presidential nominee. He said, I think we should go. This is our convention making our nominee, so I think everyone should participate. So Paul Ryan, he's urging unity. Would this apply even to a Donald Trump?
Sure. Yes, I think so.
Yeah, I think this is about brand identity, right? You want a party that's perceived as unified, so that it's not just the presidential election that they're concerned about, but it's also these down ballot races as well, right? There's a need for unity and enthusiasm among the base, so that you can get these volunteers that are critical to, you know, state Senate and state House campaigns and congressional campaigns and all sorts of things, right? The national convention is a rallying point for the party, and that rallying affects not just the presidential election, but all sorts of other races down to the local level.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Paul Ryan has been kind of put out there as a possible nominee if they go to a contested convention. And he strongly still insists that he doesn't want to be the nominee for 2016. Here he is speaking with Stephen Colbert last night on The Late Show.
I have said I do not want, nor would I accept, the Republican nomination.
Got it. So you're considering the nomination?
No, I'm not.
Okay, I'll give you some time to mull this one over. How about now?
Still no.
So that's a maybe?
No, it's a no.
Like a no-no? Or one of those, no, I don't want to be Speaker of the House, but I'll accept it if you just give it to me no's?
It's a no-no.
So, Stephen, do you believe him?
No. I mean, he said no. I'm saying no. I don't believe him, and the reason is basically that you never can turn down a request by your party, by your base, by your leaders to serve the party. Mm. You can never do that. And if it becomes absolutely necessary and there is chaos at the convention and things are going south, they will ask him, and I think he will have to say yes. But what he's trying to do is, I guess, push everything towards someone becoming the candidate and his not having to do that. Remember, he only took the speakership because he was sort of forced to.
Mm-hmm.
he didn't really want it.
Hans, if the party chose Paul Ryan, how much would that shake up voters? I mean, this is someone that the voters did not vote for, and this would be going against what a lot of primary GOP voters wanted.
Well, I think in order for this to happen, you'd have a lot of upset people as a result, and you, it would probably be some signal of a party that was falling apart. I think that, fortunately, perhaps for the Republican Party, this is a counterfactual that we're not going to see. I don't think that we're going to see an instance where either Trump doesn't win it on the first ballot or Cruz on the second or third. I think it would have to be a strange set of circumstances where they're gridlocked and can't come to support one of those two particular candidates. So I don't think that we're going to get to that point. And I think that's not really going to be a possibility. I think that the way that Trump is going, there's a good possibility that he can clinch that nomination on the first ballot. If not, the way that Cruz has been working to try to get delegates favorable to him suggests that he's going to have a good shot at getting on the second or the third if it goes that far.
I'd like to take a call briefly before the break. Jim is calling from Dubuque. Hi, Jim. Welcome to the show.
Hi. It's kind of ironic that they're now talking about changing the rule that you have to pass within eight states to be considered a rule which they put in place in order to keep the public's desire for Ron Paul's recognition from being expressed.
No.
It seems like the powers that be will do anything to keep their gravy train going, and it seems as though we're headed toward if not already in a banana republic imitation of a democracy.
Well, thanks for your call, Jim. So, Stefan, sounds like we might see a lot of cynicism here, depending on what happens.
Well, you know, the real problem is actually that we have ignored for years the fact that the Democratic and Republican parties are private organizations. There's nothing in the Constitution about them. They're like a country club. They're like a golf club. And golf clubs can write their own rules, and the parties write their own rules because that's part of what they can do, and it may not seem like it's fair, but that's life.
Mm, we're talking politics today, 2016 presidential election. When we get back from the break, we're going to be talking about the results of the Democratic primary, as well as what could happen in the 2016 election in terms of Iowa's open Senate seat and local politicians at the Iowa State House. You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. Email us at rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org, or you can tweet us at IPRTalk. I'm Emily Woodbury, and I'm here with Stefan Schmidt of Iowa State University and Hans Hassel of Cornell College. We'll be back in just a few minutes. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Good afternoon and welcome back. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury in for Ben Kiefer. Today, I'm joined by Stefan Schmidt. He's a university professor of political science at Iowa State University, and Hans Hassel. He's an assistant professor of political science at Cornell College. And we want to hear from you. You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. Or tweet us at IPR Talk. Today, we're going to be talking about the Democratic primary results, what's ahead for the 2016 election in terms of Iowa's open Senate seat. And we're also going to take a brief look at local politics as the Iowa legislative session gets ready to adjourn, the governor and Republican lawmakers are considering a measure to defund Planned Parenthood. Again, you can join our conversation, 866-780-9100. So we talked in the last half of the show about the delegate count on the Republican side. Now looking to the Democratic side, I think the current count is Clinton has 139 delegates from New York. That adds to a total of 1,930 delegates, so 1,930 delegates. And Sanders received 106 delegates last night. He now has 1,189 delegates. And let's play a quick clip from Clinton's victory speech last night. Here she is speaking in New York.
In this campaign, we've won in every region of the country. From the north to the south to the east to the west, but this one's personal. New Yorkers, you've always had my back.
So Hillary Clinton obviously feeling good coming out of New York. But Bernie Sanders, you know, he didn't get a big win, but he didn't do too poorly. You know, how do you think Sanders' campaign is feeling coming out of New York today? Stefan?
I think Sanders is upset. I think Sanders is disillusioned by the fact that he didn't do better. And he's very angry because, as you know, New York has some of the worst voting laws in the United States. They have no early voting, which 37 other states have. They have no election same-day registration. You have to register ahead of time. They have no absentee ballots unless you have can prove that you're out of town or have a disability, and proving that is very difficult. And so the kind of people that Bernie Sanders wanted to attract really didn't do well. And plus, you know, there is that whole issue of voter registration lists in Brooklyn being purged. I mean, they purged 100 and some thousand names from the voter registration list, and no one knows why. Why did that happen? Were they potential Bernie Sanders supporters? So there is Bernie Sanders is quite angry. Well, and Bernie Sanders is still also upset that the superdelegates are going mostly to Hillary Clinton. You know, mm-hmm. 502 of them are going to Hillary and not him. If he could get those 502 that are pledged now to Hillary, he would come close to Hillary. He would have 1,653 delegates to Hillary's 1,930. But the superdelegates are going with Hillary Clinton, and he's not happy with that.
Well, let's talk about this, the purge that you mentioned. I mean, this was kind of a mess last night. We had, like in Iowa, there were long lines, understaffed, but also registered voters had to resort to casting affidavit ballots. Tens of thousands of voters were dropped from the rolls. And then you have the mayor of New York, Bill de Blasio, calling for major reforms to the Board of Elections. And now voters and advocacy groups today are turning to the federal district court to have provisional ballots before the results are certified. So, you know, we're talking about the results today, but could this have a significant influence on the final results, Hans?
I mean, I agree with Stefan. First off, having worked with election returns in the state of New York, they're atrocious compared to most other states. Right? In Iowa, we think of having you know, access to information about the results, and it's easy to find and easy to access. It's not at all the case in New York. It's a very difficult process that's largely opaque. And the ability of people to understand what's going on, and exactly as you mentioned, right, they have very restrictive voter registration laws. I'm not sure that this is going to make a whole lot of difference in terms of the outcome, and that's primarily right because you're looking at demographics, right? Who are the people that are likely to vote for Bernie Sanders? They're the people that are just becoming involved now in politics. They're this younger generation. And those are individuals that are harder to get out, right? And New York's registration laws, as as Stephen mentioned, are very, very difficult, right? This is the same thing that happened with Donald Trump's children. They couldn't vote for him because they hadn't registered back in October as a member of the party, right? You had to be registered as a partisan back way before anybody had any clue that this election was going to be competitive.
Can I add something here? I think that this voter fraud is a story that may have legs and that can continue to be discussed. That there already people are saying that it was Clinton supporters and operatives in New York State who were part of her organization when she was senator and who have connections to the Clinton Foundation and so on were very likely involved in some form or another for the voter list being purged. If that story continues and there's investigative reporting, this is terrible for the Democratic Party, and it's especially terrible for Hillary Clinton. Because as you know, once a rumor gets going and once people begin to suspect someone, Hillary Clinton has already got all kinds of problems with credibility and truthfulness and so on. And if this story unfolds. And I can guarantee you right now, guarantee that this afternoon when Rush Limbaugh is on the air, and he's already on the air in some parts of the country, the Republicans are going to drill down on this. They're going to talk about how the Clinton machine is once again doing nasty and illegal things. So it can be just one more drip on Hillary Clinton's campaign, which she does not need.
Helping the Republican Party more than the Bernie Sanders campaign.
Yeah, I mean,
sort of
undermining her credibility, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me throw out a hypothetical here. Let's say, so the results aren't certified. Let's say after counting a lot of these affidavit ballots, a lot of them were for Bernie Sanders. So would, for instance, then a Sanders sweep after counting these provisional ballots change the delegate count? Or is that delegate count final, no matter what the popular vote says?
I'm not sure I know the details of New York's delegate allocation, unfortunately. I'm not sure I'm the best one to comment. But I think that generally we're talking about a minor difference that's not going to make a huge difference in the long run, right? Stefan was referring earlier to the frustration that Bernie Sanders feels about the Democratic superdelegates. But the fact of the matter is that these superdelegates are under the same pressure that we referred to, the unbound delegates on the Republican side, right? There's a strong incentive for them to support the candidate that has a majority support in the country. And right now that's Hillary Clinton, right? That's why, in spite of the dislike of Trump among Republican elites, they're still strongly considering, right, what do we do if he gets really, really close to the nomination? Should these unbound delegates support this individual who is clearly the preferred candidate among the Republican Party voters? And so there's that pressure here. And so I think that when you're talking about what effect would this change in the number of ballots cast have for Bernie Sanders, I don't think it would have that big of a – it would not make that big of a difference. I think it's something for him to use to get supporters riled up about, and perhaps, as Stefan suggested, for Republicans to use in a general election campaign. But I'm not sure that it actually goes anywhere to actually changing the outcome that we're seeing very clearly unfold before us.
Rebecca's calling on this topic from Iowa City. Hi, Rebecca. What are your thoughts?
Hi. I have a couple of thoughts. First, that my understanding was that the number of provisional ballots cast was pretty large and that it could make a little bit of a difference. But a lot of what I wanted to say has been said. I do want to say that the way that we talk about superdelegates on radio and on television is very misleading. The superdelegates in the Democratic Party have never voted against the popular vote. So it doesn't matter, you know, who they're saying that they're pledged to or aligned to right now at all. Almost everybody was pledged to Hillary Clinton 8 years ago. And then when it came time for the convention, Obama had the majority of the popular vote. And so everybody swung the other way. And that's how it's been since the time that we've had superdelegates. They always, always support the popular vote. So to say that the Sanders campaign is upset about the number of delegates or that, you know, this is an insurmountable thing is very misleading in my mind.
All right. Thanks, Rebecca, for your call. Stefan, would you agree with Rebecca on that? What does the, you know, history say about this?
Yeah, generally that's true. Generally, you know, the candidate that is ahead, but on the other hand, that's not really hard to understand why, because essentially Barack Obama beat Hillary Clinton the last time around. He went long. He went all the way to June and got delegates in the most unlikely places and was clearly the one who was ahead. And so, you know, the question of where the superdelegates go would be more interesting, you know, if Bernie Sanders were to have a majority of the popular vote at this point but not be getting the delegates. And that's still not true. Hillary Clinton still has a majority of the Democratic popular vote. So we have to be a little bit patient here. We want to always reach the conclusion, you know, months before. Wait until June 7th, and the people, the good people of South Dakota, have had a chance to vote. And then we'll have a radio show, and we'll know what the delegate count is, who's ahead in both parties. And that'll be terrific, because then we know what the conventions are going to look like.
So I think that Rebecca is right, and what Stefan says right is correct, that superdelegates have generally supported the candidate that, you know, has the majority support among the voters. I think that the concern that the Sanders campaign has is, what does allocating those delegates to Clinton already have on the perception of individuals, and thus affect their motivation to turn out to vote, right? So if I'm an individual that looks at the delegate count and says, oh, right, there's no way that Sanders can catch Clinton, you know, I would support Sanders, but there's no hope in my vote actually making a difference here. And so I'm going to stay home, and I'm not going to turn out. And so I think that's the concern really about including these superdelegates in these counts, is that it changes the narrative of the campaign. It changes it from it being a relatively close race to, right, Clinton is the presumed nominee, and it's going to be very difficult to affect her. So it's this horse race coverage of the media aspect that affects voter behavior. And that's why it's a concern to the campaign, not because they don't think that they can switch them if they start winning a majority of the voters, but the fact that it's included in there, which makes a close race seem not as close.
If you've just tuned in, this is Politics Day on River to River. I'm talking with political analyst Stefan Schmidt and Hans Hassel. We have another call from Iowa City. Jeff is calling in. Hello, Jeff.
Oh, hello.
Hi. What are your thoughts as you're listening to the discussion?
I've just been looking at the election returns from New York. There are a couple of interesting things about them. One is that Senator Clinton overperformed in terms of the polls. And why is that? And, you know, in her overperformance is almost entirely due to New York City and the adjacent suburbs. But Senator Sanders pretty much carried or tied in the rest of the state. And I just wonder if this doesn't have to do with his last minute mention of the Palestinians. This was a kind of unprecedented intervention in politics. And to do this in New York City, where there is a very large concentration of people who are strongly committed to Israel, may explain the margin that Senator Clinton got. And whether this will hold up in other states or not, I don't know. But there seems to be a kind of Palestinian quotient going on here. She was ahead 10% in the aggregate polls, and she won by 15%. So right. I'll throw that out.
Well, that's an interesting comment, Jeff. I'm sorry. We're running out of time on the show. But to that point, so we have Bernie Sanders, who is a Jewish candidate, and then we have his comments on Palestine and Israel. Stefan, how do you see this impacting his voter base in New York, which has a large Jewish population?
Yeah, I don't buy it. I mean, how many Republican Jewish voters are there in New York? There aren't that many. And yes, the Republican Party is very much a supporter of Israel. But we're talking about Bernie Sanders, aren't we? We're not talking about the Republican Party. And so I'm not sure how this is all going to roll out. I think Bernie Sanders went to the Vatican and didn't stay in New York and campaign up to the last minute. It didn't help him very much, I don't think. And frankly, there is the question of whether Bernie Sanders is the best candidate to run in November. And I think voters in New York kind of judged the two and said, well, Hillary Clinton has more experience. She's got the establishment behind her. She's got the super delegates committed. And I agree with Hans that it is highly unfair to quote the numbers of delegates with the super delegates presumably included, and the fact that they have said that they're going to support Hillary Clinton at this point in time. That is not a good thing to be doing to Bernie Sanders. Well, and that all hurt him. That all hurt him.
Thanks again for your call, Jeff. And like I said, we are coming up to the end of the hour very fast. Lots of discussion. I would like to ask you both about a couple local issues, though.
Yeah.
This week, there was a controversial measure to defund Planned Parenthood because the organization performs abortions. This is again being considered by the Iowa State House, and it now has the support of Governor Branstad. Here is the governor speaking yesterday in a press conference about a bill sponsored by the House Republicans.
I think this avoids controversy, and it's a good way to provide the services for needy women at the same time on not getting into that controversy. And I'm hopeful that it will be approved by this General Assembly.
So do you think this is kind of an example to Democrats that even with having a Democratic president in the White House, specifically the president vetoed federal legislation to defund Planned Parenthood, without the emphasis on local elections, the other side can really push their agenda? Do you think that's true, Hans?
Well, absolutely. And this is federalism in its kind of classic sense here, right? We've got responsibilities. Right? The national government has oversight of certain responsibilities. The local government has and state government has oversight of certain responsibilities. Sometimes those responsibilities overlap. And so what you've got here is an example where both the national government and the local and state governments are involved in this. The national government doesn't act, but the state government does. And this is, you know, this is part of the way that our government is set up, that you have different areas that are able to do things in the way that best suits them. In Iowa here, the Republicans are pushing this particular issue.
Mm-hmm. And specifically, I should say, this isn't a bill in itself. The measure to defund Planned Parenthood has been added to a human services budget bill. Stefan, what do you think the likelihood is of this bill passing in conjunction with that human services budget bill?
Well, I mean, the problem is for them, you know, you still have Democrats controlling the Senate. And remember, you know, your government 101 bills pass both houses and then, you know, they're rectified so that they have the same language and then they go to the executive for the signature. And I think the Democrats who control the Senate are probably not going to vote for it. I don't know. I mean, some of them may defect, in which case the bill will pass. This particular defunding will pass connected to another bill. It may very well. I haven't seen the latest news. I don't know where the bill is right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting you bring up the House. So you have, you know, in Iowa, you have the House Republicans that have control, and in the Senate, you have Democrats in control. But some analysis from Ballotpedia, this website that tracks elections,
yep,
it's identified our state Senate as one of 20 battleground chambers in this upcoming election in November. Do you think Republicans will be able to take the Senate based on this current legislative session and based on all the national politics that we're talking about here?
Well, go ahead.
I was going to say, state House elections and state Senate elections generally follow national politics. And so I think that you're going to have a good sense about whether Republicans are going to be able to do that in a couple of months once we know who the presidential nominee is. And if that nominee is someone that can rally people to their cause, I think that there's a very good likelihood that Republicans could take that. As it is right now, I think that some of the candidates out there have some major flaws that may turn off a whole bunch of voters. And as a result, many people may not show up to the polls. Many Republicans that would have voted Republican will either stay home or will vote Democrat.
This seems like we're just raising the stakes even more on this presidential election. We have the Supreme Court nomination. We got local elections, Senate seats. Stefan, what are your thoughts about
I agree with Hans. It also depends, however, on whether the Democrats can find good candidates and actually win. Because the Democrats, I mean, the last time around Barack Obama won re-election, the Democrats were wiped out in Iowa. We lost, you know, the party lost the Senate seat to Joni Ernst. It lost, you know, 3 out of 4 House seats. It doesn't have a lot of even statewide elections. And so the Democrats are going to have to do a lot better, and they can't just count on the national atmosphere doing it. So it all depends on that as well.
Well, we've come to the end of the hour today. I want to thank everyone who called in. I want to thank my guest, Stefan Schmidt of Iowa State University. Thanks, Stefan.
Thank you.
And Hans Hassel of Cornell College. Thanks a lot, Hans.
Thanks so much.
And coming up tomorrow on the show, we're going to be talking about robotics in healthcare, robotics in the hospital room. We have things like therapy and companion animals, actually robotic animals that help with dementia patients and with children. We're going to be talking about surgical robotics, the use of telemedicine, and in the future, possibly artificial intelligence, specifically IBM's Watson supercomputer that could be helping diagnose you. That's in the future. And all of that is coming up tomorrow on River to River at noon. River to River is produced by Claire Roth and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Dennis Reese. You can find on-demand audio of our show at iowapublicradio.org. You can also contact us anytime with your comments and questions, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Emily Woodbury. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio.